This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to our second session of Islamic at Authors with myself, Usama Al-Azami. And I'm delighted to have with me today Dr. Jonathan Brown, or Professor Jonathan Brown, as we'd say, a dear friend, but also one of the, in my estimation, most interesting scholars in the field of Islamic studies in terms of just the sheer range of topics that he covers. And we'll be discussing, inshallah, his recent book, Slavery and Islam. Just a brief introduction to Professor Brown, who will be well known to a lot of our viewers. He's currently the Walid bin Talal Chair of Islamic Civilization in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He got his PhD at the University of Chicago, an extremely well-travelled scholar and extremely well-published scholar who's written on topics from Hadith studies to Quranic studies to early Islamic history to all sorts of fascinating topics, including the controversial, which basically covers today's topic. So inshallah, the standard format will be I will allow Professor Brown to cover this topic. I know Jonathan Brown for a long time, so I will go ahead and call you Jack, if that's all right.
That's fine.
So Jack will inshallah be covering this topic for maybe about 10 minutes, just giving us an idea of what motivated him to write the book and, in a sense, what the main themes of the book are. After which, I will launch into a discussion in the standard way. And that discussion will go on for at least half an hour. And if anyone has any questions, we'll try and cover those questions towards the end of our discussion. Jack has been very kind to suggest that if we find that the discussion is going on over an hour and there is interest on the part of the viewers, that we could potentially go on for a bit longer, depending on your circumstances, of course, Jack. And I understand you're you have other responsibilities as we all do. Please feel free to let me actually, before I let you take things over, I want to emphasize people are free to write in questions. They will come up to us as comments. And you can also, I would encourage you all to buy the book, and there's a link that's present in the either the video description on YouTube or on the the post on Facebook. I think that this is really an extraordinary work that a lot of people should be reading. So please do consider buying it. And let me ask Jack to go ahead. Bismillah.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. This book, Slavery and Islam, was really something that was the topic that I basically, by the way, everything I say now is actually in the book. So if you're interested in more, reading it instead of hearing it, you can find it in the book. But when I was when I first became Muslim, it was probably about 19 years old. And early on, I remember I was reading the translation of the Quran, and I came across a verse in Surah An-Nahl, the verse Surah 16, where God compares, Abdun Mamlukun la yaqdiru ala shay, and then so a slave who's owned that cannot do anything versus someone who God has given like good sustenance to, right? And this is actually a parable of, people who call on false gods versus call on the God, right? So false gods are like slaves that can't do anything, right? And I was struck. I mean, I remember being struck because I was like, wait a second, you can't just mention slavery. Like, you have to say something about how slavery is wrong. Like, you can't just talk about slavery. And then it wasn't even saying, go get a slave or do this with a slave. It was just mentioning it as a parable, like as a sense, figuratively. So that I was like, well, that's kind of, I don't understand. But anyway, it wasn't a big deal. I think that like maybe like a lot of Muslims, you know that the Quran talks about the slavery, talks about freeing slaves a lot, right? But you know, you can. It's not really a big issue that comes up a lot for, at least for me, it wasn't. Then of course, so I went out of my mind. But then when the ISIS thing happened, right? There was this, you know, a lot of these newspaper articles came out, like in the New York Times, you know, ISIS and the theology of rape and everything. Although it turns out actually that some of the reporting on that was inaccurate. The reporter was basically reprimanded
making up
for
stuff.
That. Yeah, or just, yeah, like basically it was, you know, not, there was stuff that was not well authenticated. So anyway, the you know, that was became a really big issue. A lot of Muslims were, you know, they were in shock because like here's all these guys saying that they're following the Quran and the Sunnah, and they're enslaving, you know, Yazidis and Christians and other people in Iraq and Syria, and you know, and they're saying like, well, this is in the Quran, this is in the Hadith, this is in the Sharia, so what's the big deal, you know? And Muslims didn't really know how to answer that, and some of the responses were by Muslim scholars like, well, there's, you know, consensus that slavery has been prohibited. It's like, well, okay, so what? So a bunch of people today say something, but I'm telling you, I'm following the Quran, the Sunnah, and, you know, what's your answer? That today we decided we're not going to do that? That doesn't really seem like an answer. So it was a really big issue for a lot of Muslims. And I mean, I completely understand. So I really wanted to deal with this topic kind of and try and answer these questions. And I guess the main question in the book, sort of runs out throughout the book, is how do you, what do you do when the source that you consider to be morally authoritative seems to allow something that you consider morally reprehensible? So how do you deal with that? Like, how do you even make sense of your feeling of moral reprehensibility? Like, how do I, if I'm Muslim and I'm supposed to follow the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet, and they know best, why is it that I feel so strongly that slavery is wrong? So first of all, why do I have that feeling? How do I make sense of that? Second of all, how do I make sense that my feeling contradicts these authoritative sources? And what does that mean about the kind of truth value of those sources, or those the ability of those sources to offer me guidance? So that's a huge question. Now, of course, I was writing this book at the same time as this protest took place in Charlottesville, I think it was 2017, about taking down the statue of Thomas Jefferson. Now, Thomas Jefferson had slaves. Thomas Jefferson had a slave concubine that he had children with, Sally Hemming. And George Washington had slaves, and this whole idea that George Washington was like, you know, he didn't want to have slaves, he freed them all. There's a book I recommend reading called Never Caught, about Ona Judge, who was a slave girl who was enslaved, you know, from her parents were slaves, of the Washington family. She ran away when the Washingtons were in Philadelphia, and they spent the rest of their lives hunting for her. Like they are always trying to get her back. So this idea that they didn't just say, "Oh, it's fine. It's good. It's good. She left. You know, we wanted to free her anyway." No, not at all. So, when this happened, you know, it was funny because Donald Trump came out and sort of said what I more succinctly than I could brought up the point, which is he said, "Okay, George Washington's a slave owner. Are you going to take down the statues of George Washington? Are you going to rename everything in America that's named Washington, which is pretty much everything?" And here, this was the crux of what I was interested in, right? Which is that that's what I call the slavery conundrum, right? So you have three axioms, and you can't really reject any of them. Maybe you can, but we'll talk about that. You can't really reject any of them. But you also can't hold all three of those axioms at the same time. So it's a conundrum. The first axiom is that slavery is a intrinsic and gross evil throughout space and time. So, and this is all stuff that now we, you know these are fixed points of inquiry. These are axiomatic in our society. So slavery is evil. It was evil, it's evil today, it was evil 100 years ago, it was evil 1,000 years ago, it was evil 2,000 years ago, evil 3,000 years ago, right? And if you want to say that that's not axiomatic, try going into any kind of social setting and saying that slavery was actually okay 200 years ago or something. See what'll happen, and then, you know, we'll talk later. The second maxim is that all slavery is slavery. So there's no such thing as like good slavery, bad slavery. You can't say, yeah, Thomas Jefferson had slaves, but like he was a really nice guy, so he treated them well. No. There's no such thing as, you know, any type of slavery is unacceptable. Slavery is a gross and intrinsic moral evil throughout space and time. Two, all slavery is slavery. Three, our past has some kind of moral or even legal claim over us. So we look to our past for guidance. Maybe we look to our past for strict rules. Now, here's the problem. If you look at human heritage, so the heritage of human beings, prior to, let's say, the year 1690, prior to the year 1690, in all of world history, I know of 1, 2, 3 people in all of human history. I don't mean in like the West. I mean in everywhere that I know of. Three people who said that slavery in and of itself is evil, is a moral evil. Not enslaving the wrong people, not treating your slaves badly. I mean that is slavery in and of itself is an evil.
Can you mention those people?
Yeah, one is Gregory of Nyssa. He's a bishop, one of the church fathers, a bishop from Cappadocia. He died in 394, I think, the common era. The other one is Jean Baudin. He's a French jurist and historian and kind of man about town, Renaissance man. He died in 1596, if I'm not mistaken. Right. And the third one is a German jurist named A.K. von Repgau, who he's in the early 1300s, if I'm not mistaken. He wrote a book called The Saxon Spiegel, the Saxon Mirror, which is, I think, one of the earliest books, kind of Germanic law books. And he basically repeats Gregory of Nyssa's arguments with a little bit of adjustment. So that's it. So here's the thing, right? Now, look, if people who are saying, like, we should take down the statue of Thomas Jefferson, people are saying we should take down the statue of that guy in Bristol, people who are saying we should, you know, change the name of this building or that building because this guy was involved in the slave trade, they're completely right. They are totally correct. Logically speaking, they are completely correct. Slavery is a gross and intrinsic evil across space and time. All slavery is slavery. If you're involved in that, if you're involved in a gross and intrinsic evil throughout space and time, something that's so horrific, no one can countenance it. Why would you ever honor that person? Why would you ever look to that person for guidance? I mean, Osama, do you take advice from people who think slavery is okay? do you ask them, like, I don't know what I should do in this situation, Osama, you know, I don't know what I should do. What do I do ethically?
Right.
You know, tell me about God. No, we would. It's ridiculous. They're completely correct. But here's the problem. It means you're going to take at the very least, all of human history prior to 1690 into the garbage can. That's it. And then, you know, then we can talk about the 1700s, 1800s, whatever, you know, we can talk about Thomas Jefferson, all these other people. But at the very least, every single philosophical tradition of note that I know of, every religion that I know of, all were either condoned slavery, had no problem with slavery, maybe defended slavery, thought it was totally normal. So what do you do? That's a big predicament. Some people might be willing to pay that cost. Some people might, yeah, you're right. Let's get rid of all of human heritage before 1700. Why not? If it's evil, it's evil. Get rid of it. But not a lot of people are willing to pay that cost. And certainly people who look to revealed traditions that come from, you know, the classical period or whatever, the axial age or after, they wouldn't usually be willing to pay that. So that's, That's the main kind of issue I'm wrestling with in the book. I'll summarize the book really quickly now. So the first chapter is I talk about definition of slavery. And the main point I'm trying to make there is that really when you define slavery, it's a very political action. And it's a lot of things. It's about defining kind of what you think slavery is as opposed to what, you know, other people might do, right? So it's about kind of saying who matters, whose suffering matter, whose suffering doesn't matter. Now, there is no agreed upon definition of slavery. That's not necessarily a problem, right? So there's no agreed upon definition of religion. You and I are sort of in religious studies, and there's no agreed upon definition of religion, religious studies. But that's not a big deal, because if you say religion is this or that, no one says you're an evil person. But here's the problem. With things like terrorism and slavery, these words that are not agreed upon in terms of their definition, but if you are guilty of those things, you become kind of you have been cast out of the circle of discursibility or thinkability, right? Then that's the problem, right? So when these definitions are both there's a degree of subjectivity, there's a problem of subjectivity there, but also they're used as these they can be used as moral cudgels. That becomes really problematic. The second chapter looks at the history, slavery and Islamic law. Third chapter is a kind of overview of slavery and Islamic civilization. Then I talk about abolition of slavery in Islam. I give the different approaches Muslims have taken to that. I say what I think the best approach is. In the next chapter, I look at and analyze their approaches from the problem of the slavery conundrum. And then the last chapter deals with kind of puts all this together and looks at the issue of sex concubines, basically in Islamic law, male owners having sex with female slaves.
Right, so very light reading, shall we say. Jazakumullah khairan. I mean, that's a wonderful summary of actually a very, very sort of, a fairly lengthy work, which will... I think this may be the longest book you've written. Is that fair to say?
I think so. Yeah.
And but it certainly rewards spending the time on it, and indeed sort of reading your extensive footnotes as well. I think you've covered a lot of fascinating terrain in what you've just said. But I want to emphasize to people that, as you put it at the outset, this is in the book, but the book has so much more. It's extremely rich. It's extremely well researched. So please do try and get your hands on it to be able to read it. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions, viewers are already sort of sending in their questions, so inshallah we'll try and get to you within the next half hour or so. And wa alaikum salam to Samina Awan, who's just given salam to us. Why 1690? What were you mentioning? You were mentioning before 1690. I just was curious.
That's around. There's around when these this one Quaker tract is anti-slavery Quaker tract is written in Pennsylvania.
Right, and you kind of spoke in passing that who's going to discard everything before 1690? Maybe some people will, and I actually think that the reality is, so much of our laws, so much of our sort of like society and culture is so deeply embedded in a history that, sees itself going back to the ancient Greeks, for example, or to Magna Carta or what have you. Our institutions couldn't survive that kind of, extirpation, so to speak, of history. But I think that you present the dilemma in a very compelling way. How do you accept moral guidance from a tradition, whether it's religious, in my view, whether it's religious or irreligious, because moral philosophy in the modern world, which is largely secular in the academy, for example, still draws on sort of these kinds of norms that are pre-modern as well, even if they're very often critical about them. So how do you deal with that conundrum? One of the things that I'm curious to sort of I actually read the book about 6 to 8 months ago, and I've gone through sort of certain sections in advance of this meeting. But I'm just curious, I can't recall a very detailed treatment of a kind of Islamic theological question that, arises in these sorts of contexts. So I want to compare it with Sherman Jackson's fascinating book on the problem of black suffering. which covers, again, a very similar sort of moral dilemma. And he is, you know, perhaps a lot more sort of, he doesn't show himself to be very directly implicated in the debate in the way that you point out in the beginning. You know, you're a white male and you're a Muslim, and therefore there are two traditions through which you are an inheritor of slave ownership. And he, of course, being an African-American, is more likely to be at the receiving end of that tradition. But he doesn't, in my recollection, you know, make such a big issue of it. And he presents the four.
Well,
sort of
also,
like...
you know, for all we know, his ancestors owned slaves, too, in Africa. I mean, so
what's interesting
is if you look in, I mean, look, I'm not, you know, I'm happy to admit my more immediate guilt in any number of issues. But I mean, what's interesting about this is that, you know, human history is one in which all of us are descendants of slave and slave owners, probably,
I think,
right?
Yeah.
At some point or the other, yeah.
And I think this is what's fascinating for me, because, you know, we also have these kind of DNA tests that you can do. I don't know how accurate they are and what scientists think of them. But they show us as being all deeply intermixed as a kind of human society. So my question, I went on a bit of a digression, but my question is, from the Ash'ari perspective, to a certain extent, you know, this is a question of tahsin and taqbih, right? You know, what is moral evil? And this certainty that we have in the modern period, I'm just speaking sort of obviously into sort of theological theory here, but these certainties that we have in Ash'arism, it's like, wait, we don't actually have any moral certainties. And so I wonder if that's something that you reflect on in the book. I cannot recall that being a particularly salient feature.
Yeah, so I talk about that. Now, it's interesting because there's a... there's a prominent Muslim scholar in the West whom I have a lot of respect for, so I'm not going to name this person. I'll just say that they, you know, this person wrote in several of their books that Qadi Abdul Jabbar, the famous Mu'tazili Shafi scholar, died 1025, I think.
Right.
That he says that slavery, riq in slavery in Islam, is... it's a kind of, it's morally evil and intrinsically in and of itself. Now, he never says this in his books. By the way, that scholar never gives the citation.
But right.
I looked through this book, and also so did Sharon Jackson. And he never says this. In fact, Qadi al-Jabbar says the opposite. Now, if you're a Mu'tazilite, there, you cannot, the things that are allowed by law, by God, have to also be morally right. So the things are, you know, the relationship of like exactly how things are right and wrong in the world is another issue. But the point is that things are right and wrong in and of themselves in the world.
Right.
And there can't be contradiction between that and what God says. So God, for example, can't say murder somebody because murder is wrong. Now, for Ash'ari, you could say God could say murder somebody because the definition of just is what God says. Okay. Now, from Mu'tazila, so Qadi Abdul Jabbar, if you're a Mu'tazilite, he can't say slavery is wrong. Why? Because the Quran allows it. So he says, in fact, he says, the fact that God allows slavery means it has to be hasan, has to be good.
Right.
Now, yeah. So Muslims scholars never, no pre-modern Muslim scholar that I know of, nor could I conceive of them doing this, ever said that slavery was evil in and of itself.
Right.
Okay, remember, by the way, except for those people I said earlier, nobody said this.
Yeah.
I'm not just from Muslims.
Yeah.
Now, what would they say? They always, though, acknowledge it was harmful. There's two things. One, in Islamic law and Islamic theology, humans are born free. This is not a Muslim invention. Roman law also said that the default status for human beings is freedom. If a human just flops out of the womb, all things being equal, that person's free.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
The difference between, let's say, us and the Romans is that the Romans said there are certain ways that you can legally be enslaved. This is the same thing Islamic law said.
Right.
Now, if the default of human existence is freedom, And Muslim scholars were also clear that only God owns our freedom. God owns our freedom. But God can allow certain situations in which people can lose their freedom.
Right.
They can lose it, let's say, if they commit a crime or something like that, right?
Right.
Or in the Quran, the Sunnah, if you are a non-Muslim outside of the Islamic world and you get captured in a war with Muslims.
Right.
Then the Muslim can take you and they can keep you as a slave.
I mean, losing freedom... Forgive me, losing freedom because of a crime is not something which is in the Islamic tradition. Quite
Muslims use prisons at various points in history.
So right,
the point is they take somebody and they put someone in a prison. We would say that is not being free, right?
Right.
And by the way, it's interesting that, you know, when Muslim scholars talk about this, kind of legal theorists and morals or moral and legal theorists talk about this, they freedom and slavery are controlled by the state. They're held by the ruler, the government, as almost like in lieu of God. So just like the sultan or the government can have you executed if you commit a crime.
Right.
Like they're the ones who hold this right of God. They also hold the right of God in terms of freedom.
So Ahkam Sultani.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But so when let's say, you know, Ahmed the Muslim owns a slave in Cairo in 1500. It's not so Ahmed the Muslim owns the right of using that slave. The actual freedom and slavery status of that person is held by the government.
Fascinating.
That's why, for example, the government can say, you're mistreating your slave. I'm going to make you free the slave, or I'm going to take the slave from you, or something like that. So there's this oversight based on the same way that the Prophet would oversee. Like if someone came and said, this guy stole from me, or this guy murdered my cousin, right?
Right.
So Muslim scholars never said that slavery was evil. Hmm. But they did say it's unnatural. And by unnatural, I don't mean like it's like incest or something. But I mean it's unnatural. It's not the natural state of human beings.
Right.
Something has to happen to you if you become a slave.
Sure.
Now, but they also said it's harmful. It has darar. Darar means harm.
Right.
Why is it harmful? They say this very explicitly. You can't do whatever. You can't make your own decisions. You can't do whatever you want. You don't get to benefit from all the fruits of your labors.
Right.
You're not a complete legal person. So, for example, in most schools of law, slaves can't own property. Some schools of law, slaves can't lead prayers. Some schools of law, slaves, you know, couldn't be a witness in court. So you're not a complete legal person. So the reason why freeing a slave is good and... And by the way, I don't know of any source, scriptural tradition, or work of thought that is as obsessed with emancipation as the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet. The Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet are obsessed with emancipation, with emancipating slaves. So why are they so obsessed? Because Muslim jurists would say, or legal theorists would say, slavery is harmful. And so but there's a difference. The harm for them did not outweigh the ownership right of the owner.
Right.
Right. Now, someone might say also, like, wait a second, you said the Quran and the Sunnah are obsessed with emancipation. Well, why didn't the Quran just say slavery is prohibited?
Right.
Because nobody said that. No society that had slaves, which is pretty much every society, certainly every civilization, ever suggested the abolition of slavery until the early modern period, until really the 1700s and 1800s.
Right.
Why is that? I mean, that's another issue we can talk about. I don't know if you want to talk
about it. I wonder if
later.
Anyone ever sort of what other traditions prohibited alcohol, for example, in the pre-modern tradition. I know prohibition took place in the United States, but that's kind of a modern state kind of effort. But it would be an interesting comparative exercise. I mean,
the thing is that, you know, some people say, well, why, you know, oh, the Quran didn't prohibit slavery because it would be impossible.
Right.
Well, I mean, it was difficult to prohibit alcohol. It was difficult to prohibit polygamy. I mean, sorry, to prohibit polytheism.
Yeah.
But Islam did that.
Right.
In addition, it's possible, right, that the Quran or the Prophet could have said, look, we can't prohibit this, but this is wrong.
Right.
But they don't say that. But the point is that I think the reason why, and just to make a slight digression, but I think it makes sense, which is, but one of the things that I get emailed about once a week, once or twice a week, I get email from somebody saying, I can't understand how people pass a loud sleep.
Fascinating.
That, you know, and it's always causing them great consternation, anxiety. So, I mean, this is probably because I'm a professor and I think about all this stuff all the time.
And you've written a book about it.
But what really interests me is how could they have thought it, but why is it that I don't think that? Right. So, I mean, if we're looking at kind of humanity, everybody in humanity who's ever lived, get them up on stage. You've got Aristotle, Buddha, the prophet, Moses, you know, everybody. Right. And you say, okay, everybody who thinks slavery is evil intrinsically in and of itself, go over here. And everyone thinks that slavery is not evil intrinsically in and of itself, go over there. The people who think it's evil are going to be very, very small. And they're going to be from a very specific time and place in human history. So here's the thing. Do those guys not have hearts? I don't understand. These earlier people, they're like dysfunctional. Their hearts don't work. Their brains don't work. I don't get it. How can they not feel the way I feel? I think that forced us to ask, really, what does our revulsion mean? How do we think about morality, right? How do we, it's not a problem, for example, for us to say we think slavery is wrong, because slavery is not really an issue today.
Right.
It becomes a problem when we want to talk transhistorically about all morality being the morality that should apply for everyone throughout history.
Can I interject briefly here? I mean, this is another point where, you know, you're a historian. I was trained as a historian in my undergraduate years. And one of the things that's kind of drilled into you is, you know, don't think anachronistically, right? Don't bring your own moral universe up to bear upon the people you're studying in the past who, you know, as Quentin Skinner sort of famously put it, witchcraft made sense in medieval Europe, right? Or I had the good fortune to study with Jeff Stout at Princeton, who's a sort of relativist and pragmatist. And also we have the phenomenon of postmodernism, which questions fundamental truths and beliefs in objectivity and moral truth as well. And so, I, you know, this is one of the things where I found fascinating. You have this paragraph, I think towards the introduction, where you say something along the lines of, this is one of those topics where whoever writes it, they feel compelled to say, and this is wrong, right? And it just makes me wonder that actually this is one of those areas where, for all our sort of commitment to sort of secularism in the modern academy, there are certain sacred points which we cannot, you know, really just disregard and think, actually, you can be nonchalant about that point. No, you actually have to take a moral position on it. Otherwise, you're not a member of our civilization, so to speak. And I find that fascinating as well. I think that's historically, anthropologically interesting as well, to be honest.
Well, I mean, also you can look at that with other topics as well. So if you said, you know, like different notions of truth, so there's like the coherence notion of truth or the correspondence notion of truth. I mean, there's some people who say like truth in the past doesn't exist. Like narratives of the past are just things that make sense to a community.
Right.
Now, if you look at these debates, usually what someone will then say is, well, so are you saying the Holocaust didn't happen? And then you're like, well, I mean, okay, yeah, obviously the Holocaust happened. So there's certain, I mean, I'm not making that up. That's actually what, if you look at some of these discussions, that's how the discussion plays out.
Yeah.
So the things that are the fixed points, the dogmatic underpinnings, if you will, they are, I find interesting, they're usually things that are recent changes. So like if you look at in America, I think probably in Britain too, what are the two things that you just cannot say? You can't support slavery and you cannot support pedophilia.
Interesting.
By pedophilia we mean like sexual interest in people that we legally today would consider children.
Under 18 to minors.
So, you know, I just saw this thing yesterday about like some listicle about we should stop thinking that these people are great. They were actually horrible. One of them was Charlie Chaplin, because he would have all these sexual relationships with 16 and 17 year old girls. Although the age of consent time was 16. Right. But the point, you know, like, he was garbage, he's awful. So, but if you think about these two issues, these are two issues I think I would say they're maybe the two things that you really just, they're sort of like taboo. There are two things that have inverted very recently in human history. Until very recently in human history, slavery was totally normal and uncontroversial. Until even more recently in human history, a man having interest in a nubile 14-year-old wouldn't be a debate. There's a great book on this called American Child Bride by a guy named Styrett is his last name.
Right. American Child Bride. There's a major campaign in the U.S. at the moment, as far as I understand, to change the laws because you can still get married.
Exactly.
As minor.
So, but the point is that, you know, the thing is that, and this is, I always use this example with my students. I say, look, if I told you that a guy was brutally murdered outside of campus a week ago, brutally murdered, they'd be like, oh, that's terrible. But if I say, okay, a guy a week ago, he lured in this 10-year-old girl, and then he had sex with her and ran away with her. And the students are like, ugh. You know, I mean, even me saying that right now, like, I feel like kind of disgusting feeling in my stomach, right?
Yes.
So you're like, that's messed up. Yeah. You know, everyone's quiet after that. No one says anything. But if you look in human history, all societies think murder is wrong. All societies. And I think pretty much every society would say that just randomly going up to a person in the middle of the street and bludgeoning them to death is wrong.
Right.
I mean, it's an absolute moral wrong.
Yeah.
Throughout time and space. But in terms of the societies where the second thing would be wrong, the majority of human societies in our history, even today, some places don't have a problem with that. So why is the thing that is actually
I think the luring component of it would be, I mean, in a lot of pre-modern societies, they would say, okay, well, if it's done in conjunction with a conversation with the parents, then it's okay. Or even if you read Jane Austen and things like that.
Let's say he doesn't lure. Let's say dad agrees. Her dad agrees.
Yes.
I mean, these things in Yemen that people talk about, the parents agree to it.
Right.
Okay. So, but my point is not, I mean, I think the point still stands, which is it's our reaction that we feel in our stomach. Why is our reaction stronger to something that is actually much less agreed upon as wrong by our species in history? Why is it less fierce reaction to the thing that actually is agreed upon by our species in history as an absolute moral? That's what I find. So what is, we get to think about, like, the things that we feel gut revulsion are usually relatively recent moral changes, right?
Yeah.
So that, I think, is an interesting way to think about the relationship between moral revulsion and like kind of anachronistic or transhistorical notions in morality.
And there's another dimension. Some of this stuff is really dynamite thinking, talking about it, but obviously we're engaged in a sort of reflection, which is an intellectual exercise here. We're both respected, inshallah. I hope I am a respected academic. We're both respected academics, inshallah, in reputable universities, reflecting on a question which is, you know, intellectually significant.
This is the same debate the same problem that Christian tradition has, Jewish tradition has, Buddhist tradition has, Hindu tradition has, natural law thinking has. Kantian philosophy has. Kant, by the way, read his stuff on race and slavery. While he's writing the categorical imperative, or what's a universal discourse on morality, I forget what it's called. Like, you know, he's same thing. He's saying there's certain Africans and Native Americans.
Yeah,
you know, they're so lazy, he says, that they're so they need to be enslaved in order to be productive.
Yeah. Yeah, liberal luminaries like John Locke, as you mentioned in the book,
John
Stuart Mill, John Stuart Mill and the colonization of India and civilizations and their knowledge and things like that. Yeah.
So the point is that, and another thing is, I mean, it's interesting. Like, the, you know who, I talked to so many people about this issue when I was writing this book. And there's two kind of conversations. First conversation is people just get completely disgusted and freaked out and they can't deal with it. That's the normal response.
Right.
Do you know who I can, the people that consistently I have the best discussions with this with? African-American Muslims, without a doubt. Because I think for a lot of Muslims, they don't want to deal with this and it freaks them out and they get really uncomfortable. I think African-American Muslims, this is like day one, they have to think about this.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And this is something that is like they wrestle with it.
Right.
And they have to come to terms with it or not, right? But the point is, it's not something they can kind of put under the carpet. So, yeah, for when I was writing this book, and in terms of feedback I got on it, it was from African-American Muslims, who were by far the most productive discussions.
That reminds me, actually, I have a good friend, Amandla Thomas-Johnson, who's, you know, going to be starting up, actually, a PhD at Cornell. He's recently written a book. You know, he's actually the descendant of slaves who were taken from Africa to the Caribbean, and you know, then he moved. His family moved to the UK at some point, probably part of what we had as the Windrush generation, so to speak. And then he converted to Islam, so he's actually a convert Muslim. And we've had brief discussions on this, but. To be honest, I mean, they are some of the deeper, more meaningful conversations I've had where, for what it's worth, I recommended your book to him because I thought he was saying that, you know, this is a dimension of the Islamic tradition that he was less familiar with and he wanted to really think about and explore because of the moral sort of complexity of the issue for, you know, his own personal heritage. And I think that that's something which I hope to bring him on as an Islamic author at some future juncture, and perhaps in part discuss some of, although his own book is on a different theme. This is really sort of like, there are so many threads in this conversation that could be taken up very fruitfully. I wanted to perhaps home in on, this... One element that you kind of mentioned in passing, there's a lot of material covered in this book, but I was just thinking about sort of the modern condition of what Marxists call wage slavery, right? So, there are all sorts of forms that we experience in a given moment in time, in a given moment in history, that given the nature of, modern liberalism and, in a sense, a progressive understanding of how history morally progresses, so to speak, we can come to an understanding that potentially actually the way we're living right now may be seen 100, 200 years from now as completely morally abhorrent as well. So the forms of, employment that we have. And I wonder if you have had the chance to sort of explore any of these in your sort of broad reading for this project. Notions that debt is a form of, bondage. In fact, of course, we had debt bondage historically, but, the fact that we all are going to university in massive amounts of debt, and we're then, getting a mortgage, so to speak, which will, again, embed us within a system. You have this quote from The Matrix, in the text where you're saying that we're all ultimately slaves to the system. And you say that, obviously, that's different from being owned by someone. You also have these fascinating anecdotes of slaves in very good conditions historically. One of my teachers, Sheikh Muhammad Akram al-Nidwi, once commented that most of the caliphs in Islamic history were actually children of slaves. Because caliphs often had concubines, and these would be the sons of concubines who would, of course, by giving birth to a child of their master, would thereby be freed upon their, and potentially become extremely influential figures behind the throne as well. So, that sort of like multi-layered nature of slavery, I wonder if you can comment on it, how it's difficult for us to really sort of have a uniform understanding of slavery.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the challenges is that slavery is both a metaphor and a legal concept, right? So sometimes those legal concepts and the metaphor overlap, but a lot of times they don't, but they can be kind of invoked, right? So there is no, since 1926 basically, or let's just say 1980, the last possible date, there's no legal slavery in the world. If you define slavery as a legal category that is acknowledged and can be adjudicated,
right,
there's no slavery in the world.
Right.
Now, you know, the question is how you define slavery. So one way is to say, well, it's someone being property of another person. Another way you can say is somebody who's not free. But then things like property and freedom really only make sense inside a consistent or coherent legal or moral tradition. Because if you look at kind of humanity as a whole throughout history, what is property? What is freedom? There's no property, just somebody has a right over something else. Some rights. That's freedom is the ability to do what you want, except when you're not allowed to do what you want. That's the definition. So, I mean, like, these are, it makes no, it's meaningless transhistorically.
Can I interject on one?
Yeah.
On the point of there being no legal slavery, doesn't the 13th Amendment leave a kind of space in the
No,
States?
Because I mean, people who are prisoners in prison. I mean, this is the big debate of the 13th movie, the 13th, right? Is that slavery continues by another name,
right?
But you're not, the people in prison are not slaves,
right? Right. They're not owned by the state.
They're still free people. They're just in in prison. Right. So. Now, there's a great book, if you're interested, there's called The Slavery by Another Name by Douglas Blackman, which talks about the way that, especially in the South, mostly black men, 100, 200,000 black men between 1865 and 1920s or so, would basically get arrested for, like, oh, you're loitering by the 7-Eleven. Like, right. you come to, like, okay, you're guilty of vagrancy. You need to pay a fine of $100. I don't know. Okay, you're going to prison. Oh, and now, by the way, before even anyone can find you, I'm going to give you to this company. I'm selling you to this company up in Pennsylvania to build railroads. You're going to go get worked until you die, and then they're going to bury you next to the railway. That's it. It's ridiculous. So, but that person is not legally a slave. So that's my. I'm not saying that you can't have a continuation of exploitation or coercion or whatever. The third way to think about slavery is slavery is a sort of a coercive relationship, a relationship of exploitation, a asymmetrical relationship of dependency or exploitation. This is where you get what, thought of as like modern day slavery or new abolitionism, which really starts to get articulated in the late 1990s.
Right.
And, it really works along the idea of slavery as being a coercion. So it's coerced labor with essentially no remuneration.
Right.
Now, the problem here is that what's coercion, right? If you look at a lot of the major writers on modern day slavery in the 1990s and the 2000s, and they write about prisoners, they say, look, if you're in a gulag in North Korea, yeah, you might be a slave. Okay, but if you're a prisoner in the UK or the US, you have work you can do. You can choose not to work if you don't want to work. Then you're not a slave. Okay, but now think of the whole movie 13th, and the whole idea of prison as a this sort of carceral slavery is now much more accepted, and a lot of those authors, at least one that I'm thinking of, is now says he's reconsidering the issue. What's changed? Right. The conditions have not changed. Conditions have not changed. It's just what are we comfortable calling? So that's why this idea of what is that slavery, in a lot of ways, this is a political definition. Right? What? Now, here's the thing. What coercion, if you're in a federal prison in the United States, federal prison, you have to work. You don't have to, but if you don't work, you're going to get what? You're going to get put in solitary confinement. You're going to get denied access to the canteen. And the food, prisoners usually don't serve food after about 5:30 p.m. So, no food from 5:30 p.m. to like 7 a.m.
Right.
They can deny family visits. No family, solitary confinement, starving you to death. That seems like coercion to me, especially the UN considers solitary confinement to be a form of torture. It really, like, what is coercion? A lot of people would, you know, a lot of Americans would say, well, these people aren't being coerced. They're in prison. They did something wrong. They, you know,
right.
But if you look at what happens to you if you don't work in prison, and then, by the way, where does these workers in U.S. prisons, what are they? They've done work for Victoria's Secret, for other companies, even according to like International Labor Organization definitions of modern day slavery. U.S. prisons are places that have slaves. There's no, I mean, it's just prima facie per se. They are people who are in captivity who are being farmed out to private corporations.
Right. And as you say, the film 13th, which you know, I guess we'd both recommend, it's on Netflix, for people to watch, illustrates very sort of very powerfully that, and has inaugurated this really serious debate, along with many of the scholars who are speaking in it. They've of course been writing about these themes for a while.
But here's the problem. Yeah. So let me interrupt you. But the problem is, like, you can look at cases. There's a case called Celia Dean versus France, I think early 2000s. Another one called Queen versus Tang from the Australian High Court a couple years later. And in both your cases were basically people saying, I'm a modern day slave. I'm being held in slavery. In France, in one case, in Australia, in another case. And in the first case, the I think it's the European Court of Human Rights, if I'm not mistaken, comes back and basically says, look, this person, it might be being treated badly, but they're not being treated like property. So they're kind of going back to this very property-centric understanding of slavery.
Right.
Very legalistic, formalistic understanding. Yeah. In the Australian High Court case, they said, no, if we look at the coercive relationship, we think this is slavery. Right. So you can see even in one decade or within a few years in the 2000s, the 2010s, there's these two poles about what slavery is that are like pushing and pulling against one another. And then it's like, you know, I remember, white nationalist people say, and I think this is even in the state curriculum, educational curriculum in some states in the U.S., they'll say that actually a lot of white people were slaves too, came to the Americas because they were indentured servants.
Right.
Now, by the way, there's some crazy stuff. Like the year that 1619, when Africans were first brought to the U.S., to America, North American slaves.
Yeah.
Same year, about, I think, 100 English children were bought from like the streets orphanage of London, brought them here. Almost all of them died. But my point is that some people say, well, these indentured servants were slaves. Now, someone would say.
And it's a limited period of time. Right,
indentured service. It goes for through the 1700s. I'm not sure exactly where it ends.
But no, I mean, in terms of like, you can go into. You can sell your services for, you know, to go to the New World.
Thing, right? So they'd say, someone would say, "Whoa! These people are not slaves. This African guy is like out, you know, hunting, or his village gets raided. He gets taken, put on a ship, sent to Brazil. That's a slave.
Right.
And he's going to stay there for the rest of his life. He's going to get worked until he dies." That's it. But these guys, British guys, they went and they agreed to do this. They say, I'll give up certain freedoms of mine. And even you can punish me. If I run away, you can brand me. You can chop my hand off. You can kill me. Right. But in return for my trip to the New World, I'm going to be your servant for indenture for 10 years. And then after that, I'm going to get a piece of land. I'm going to go try and make my living. Now, so those are very different. One is unwilling and one is willing. That's a good point. But guess what? According to, you know, things like International Labor Organization, other Walk Free, other anti-slavery organizations in the world today, debt bondage, indentured service is a major type of slavery today.
Sure.
So what you see is, you can think of it as like inflation of the term.
Right.
The term slavery is inflating. It's sucking up more and more things underneath it. And in one sense, this is good because, look, if there's some guy who's getting treated badly in another country, well, we don't want that to happen.
Yeah.
So what's it? But if someone says, oh, he's a slave, now suddenly, like, Bono is out there saying, we got to fight for this guy's rights or whatever, you know, and then everybody, now this guy's life is better. That's good.
Right.
But at the same time, if you expand the definition, expand it, it starts to cheapen the suffering and experience of the people who were actually slaves. And when I say actually slaves, I put quotation marks around that because modern day slavery is not a metaphor. When people talk about modern slavery, they're not saying it's like, oh, you're working, my boss is making me work like a slave.
Right.
They're saying, no, these people are actually slaves. Just like people 200 years ago were slaves, these people are slaves. But actually what we're saying when we say that, hey, wait a second, like person in American prison is not being treated as badly as a slave in the antebellum South. What we're actually doing there is saying there's different levels of slavery, and that breaks the first, the second axiom, which is you can't,
all slavery.
So you start to like, people start to get really uncomfortable, and this, the kind of discursive system starts to break down.
I just wanted to say that there are quite a few questions, and I'll be able to turn to them in just a moment, if that's all right, inshallah. But thank you, everyone, for putting in your questions, and we'll put them to Professor Brown in just a moment. I wanted to close with, you know, a reflection on what this all means for Muslims. So, obviously, you're writing both as a Western academic and as really a Muslim theologian thinking about serious questions from a Muslim perspective as well. And, you know, I really like the way in which you blend those two traditions of approaching the Islamic tradition in a very rigorous fashion. In a sense, the one of the major challenges, and I kind of hinted at this when I was referring to Ash'arism, that what is the source of our norms, right? And what you're saying is, in the slavery conundrum, that slavery is wrong. That's an axiom that we know. Slavery, slavery, slavery is wrong, etc. And it, you know, it, in a sense, is a disruption of that, you know, pre-modern Islamic moral universe where, okay, if you're an Ash'ari, norms are purely, you know, given by God. Everything that humans do are completely contingent. They, in a sense, you know, have no moral value whatsoever. Or you're a Mu'tazili, you know, as, and there are other options as well, of course. And, you know, if something like slavery has been mentioned neutrally in the Quran, or as, you know, in the case that you mentioned, which struck you so much when you had just converted, that was a neutral mention. But in other instances, it's mentioned as something that is encouraged to bring an end to through freeing of slaves and so on. So you can say there's a sense of discouragement almost, but it's not. I think neutrality is quite salient there. The Mu'tazila would seem to suggest, actually, you know, that's something which we cannot say is evil, right? And I sort of sent you in a WhatsApp message just before our session that, you know, this is a hadith. I don't believe it's mentioned in the book at all, but in Sahih al-Bukhari, where Abu Huraira says, you know, lil mamluki ajran, quoting the Prophet, that the slave has two rewards, and he mentions the rest of the hadith, and then he adds at the end, if it weren't for the Hajj and, you know, taking care of my mum, I would have loved to die a slave, right? And so there's a completely different sort of conception of what it means, because for him it's like, you know, a slave is getting a double reward, a reward for being obedient to his God and a reward to being obedient to his owner, despite all of the other harms that, you know, are recognized in the Islamic judicial tradition. And so in a sense, there's this moral sort of like challenge that, you know, I would suggest that our modern circumstances puts us into this bind that actually you have to have this sharp, strong moral position on this question. But at the same time, you have a tradition which, if you want to be a part of, you can recognize there's even moments where certain members of the tradition, like Abu Huraira, are saying, actually, there can be a moral good almost involved in being in a state of servitude. And he almost says that, you know, I wish I was a slave, right? So yeah, that complexity. I wonder if you want to just comment on that before we go to the questions, inshallah.
Yeah, I mean, by the way, like, you know, I'm not saying that Abu Huraira was like getting this from Christianity or something, but I mean, like, you see a lot in the Christian tradition, in the gospel and in the letters of writings of Paul and the gospels that Jesus is like comes in the guise of a slave, right? That the Christian is like, you know, to be a slave to their fellow man, not just to God but to their fellow man. The way that saints like Ignatius Loyola, the way that they serve other people, I mean, they serve them like slaves, That's what they, that for them is this expression of piety, or a way to train themselves in piety. I would say that, now, one thing that's important to remember is that, you know, usharis don't go around and say, like, you know, hey, Osama, like, you know, you need to cook me dinner right now, Osama. You know, oh, what's wrong? You're offended by me saying that? But God never said, don't tell someone to cook them dinner right now. And there's no right or wrong except for what God commanded. No, right. There's the, of course there's right or custom. Wrong. There's what's called urf.
Yeah.
Custom.
Yeah.
And that's what people like, you know, when Ghazali and others write about this, that's where most human morality comes from, custom. And by the way, this is how Islamic law also, we know this from one of the major, five major principles or maxims of Islamic jurisprudence, al-'ada muhakkama, or al-'ada muhakkima in another version. Custom is probative. Custom is dispositive. Custom is authoritative, as long as it doesn't violate the Sharia, obviously. Yeah. But when someone says, like, you know, like if I went and told my wife, hey, where's dinner? And don't forget to clean the dishes. And I'm gonna go to the shisha cafe with the boys. I'm gonna watch the game. I want the kids put to bed. And I'm gonna come. And then if I did that, I'll tell you where I'd be. I'll be outside the next second. The next minute, I'm gonna be outside on my butt, like wondering how I flew that far out of the house in that amount of time. And then I'm gonna get taken to court. My wife's gonna say, this guy's a deadbeat dad. I want to be divorced from him. And if there was a Sharia judge there, they'd say, yeah, this guy's a terrible husband.
Because
I am not. But what determines obligations of husbands and wives is custom.
Hmm.
Right. So these are real. Custom is real. Custom isn't like, you know, oh, I don't know what to get Osama for his wedding present. That's not custom. I mean, that is, but that's like a silly form. Custom is like these deep senses of right and wrong we have.
Hmm. Interesting.
Right. And custom can change. So now that's really important to remember. The second thing you were talking about was, I forgot now. Oh, about the
the hadith.
Yeah, Muslims scholars, like the idea of freeing slaves was something that Muslims did for pietistic reasons. They wanted reward from God.
Exactly.
They'd say sometimes you have these documents of manumission where they'd say, I do this hoping for my reward from God, right?
Right.
One of the things that people, that Muslim scholars talk about when they start discussing abolition of slavery, is some people are saying, wait a second, but then you're taking away a major good deed from people because they can't free slaves anymore. And we would say, what the heck are you talking about? Yeah. What? You crazy? Right. But that was a serious, like, for them, it was really important. The idea, the reward you got for freeing slaves is really important.
Right.
And that was a serious concern of theirs. Another thing that you mentioned, which I think was an important point, is this idea of how we look back in time at the past. So, you know, people who look back, when I just said, we look at this guy and say, are you crazy?
Hmm.
How could they not understand? Like, or you'd see, for example, Muslim scholars who would say, who'd fight, they'd literally die. They would die. And there's examples of this. Hamdan al-Jassous is a good example. Hmm. Moroccan scholar in the early 1700s. There's the ruler of Fez, Maula Ismail, orders all people who are like of African descent, of slave descent in Fez and around it to be enslaved for his army. Hamdan al-Jassous writes a fatwa against this. He's told to shut up. He's writes another one. He says, if you write another one, we're going to execute you. He writes another one. He knows he's going to execute it. He gets executed. Right. He said, if you do this, this is a mockery of the Sharia. No one has ever said this in the past. This is absolutely unacceptable.
Right.
He went to his death. But Hamdan al-Jassous could care less if a Christian got enslaved. It would just be like, okay.
Yeah.
So we would say, what's this guy's problem? Why doesn't he understand? Yeah. But if you look, read, like, for example, strict animal rights activists today, they write and they talk about animal rights as abolition. And they're not saying that as like a metaphor. They're saying, look, what is the idea that, before there was an idea that you could take, let's say, African people and enslave them.
Hmm.
And you couldn't enslave a white person.
Hmm.
How is that any different from saying, I can take a cow and put it in a cage and take its milk and kill it and eat it, but I can't do that to a human?
Right.
They'd say that's just speciesism. They say it's speciesism.
Right.
And someone would say, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. But why is it ridiculous? 100 years from now, if we're, you know, all these animals are destroying the environment anyway, it's totally environmentally unsustainable to eat meat. Yeah. This is true, yeah. Right? So yeah. 100 years from now, we're all eating, you know, whatever, the unbelievable artificial burger. We look back, we're like, what the heck was wrong with those people? They didn't understand. Yeah. These animals have rights.
Right.
So, you know, the same way that our worldview makes sense to us, the fact that someone in the past worldview doesn't make sense to us doesn't mean it didn't make very good sense to them.
Right. I guess the final point, and it's up to you, because we should really be taking some questions, but I was just thinking about the hadith of Abu Huraira, something along those lines, if that's something which... you know, how do we understand that in the sense that this is a companion? It's not obviously the Prophet saying. You have this fascinating quote. I forget the name of the scholar, and it's very early. Islam yatashawaf ila
al-hurriya.
Al-hurriya.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't appear till later. That appears in, I think, the earliest I've seen is in the 1200s.
Right.
But there's earlier. It's a hadith. It's probably not an authentic hadith, but it's something probably said by a companion or something that God wants freedom. So that's why if you say, if you're my slave and I say, you're free, Osama. No, I'm just joking. You're not free. I said you're free. Boom, that's it.
Yeah.
No, but I was joking. If we were making a deal about me buying your car, not that car you had before, by the way, which we won't get into. The one you picked me up with. Your current car, okay?
Yeah.
If I said, you know, we make a deal, I'm just joking. I'm not joking. That wouldn't be a legal contract because was never my intention to buy the car.
Yeah.
But if I say free you and it's joking or I make a mistake or something, boom, it's free. Why? God wants freedom. This is
what's the Arabic phrase that's used? And who says this again?
Allah yasha al-hurriya.
Okay. Right.
I think you can see it in the Kitab al-Tahrish of Dirar ibn Amr.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the earliest texts
have very early.
In the Islamic tradition.
Yeah.
So, that's a very important point because there's an obsession with, and the irony is one of the reasons that there's so many slaves brought into Islamic civilization from the steppes of Russia, from Turkic lands, from Europe, from Africa, from India, is because Muslims are constantly freeing their slaves.
Right.
So they're constantly having to replenish the labor supply because you don't have like a self-reproducing slave population.
So this is a point that you made in your footnote, and I think we've referred to it briefly already, which is that you know, there was a capitalist imperative to get rid of slaves, and that's one of the things that actually
there's a big debate about this. So there's a huge debate about this, and I don't understand why this is a big debate. You need to, in my opinion, this is my opinion, but you're talking to like the Douglas Murray type guys, and you start saying, or Christopher Hitchens or something, start saying, the West sucks. The West isn't that great. What are they going to say? What's their first thing they're going to say?
You guys have slaves.
No, and you guys had slaves and what? And we... especially British people. What do British people always say? What are these, like, you know, not Nigel Farage, but these other, like, Winston Churchill is great type people. We ended slavery. We ended slavery for the whole world. We went around and patrolled the oceans. So the idea that Western Europe, that the West doesn't have slaves I call it the natal miracle of Western civilization. And you can see this even in, like, you know, French historians like Marc Bloch, who said that the disappearance of slavery in Western Europe is one of the most incredible phenomena in human history. Right. So there's this, of course, it actually, I don't know if you can hear me. My camera is like, can you hear me right now?
Yeah, I can hear you. I think your internet.
I don't know why that happened. But the point is that slavery, enslavement of Europeans within Europe actually goes on a lot longer than people think. Definitely through like the 1200s in Scandinavia, and then the enslavement of people from like North Africa, Muslims in Italy, like through the 1800s. Of course, we know about the slavery in the colonies, But my point is that the idea that the West somehow is at this leading edge, is the vanguard of freedom in human history, is very important for like a Western self-identification.
It's a founding myth of Western identity.
Yeah. So this is a big debate, because when you come in, here's the question. Very simple fact, right? Something that essentially nobody in human history thought was wrong.
Yeah.
Goes from being fine to being completely, absolutely, unacceptably evil, essentially within 150 years. And how did that happen? I mean, did some people, or people in the 1800s, are they eating more protein? Are they somehow smarter? Are they better? Are they smarter than Thomas Aquinas or St. Augustine? Are they more spiritually in touch with God than St. Augustine or than the Prophet Muhammad or Buddha or Moses and all these people? No. So what happens?
There's, I mean, the narrative, of course, it very often is about, you know, we've liberated ourselves from our infancy.
But how? I mean, where is this, in Renaissance, we discovered the Greco-Roman tradition.
Yeah.
We discovered Roman law, which allows, so if you look at, almost as Muhammad, either John Locke or, my God, name is, escape me right now. He could talk the laws of our ocean. Yeah, the dies in the mid 1600s. Major early forerunner of human rights discourse, international law.
Hugo Grotius.
Exactly right. These guys, they're just operating with the Roman law tradition, where there's legal ways to enslave people, which is you capture them.
Right.
Okay. Now, and it's really only in the 1700s, in the mid and late 1700s. That you start getting like a real, this Enlightenment rejection of slavery. Why is that? It's interesting. They're reacting to, well, there's a couple of reasons, but one of the reasons is they're reacting to the Atlantic slave trade, which is horrific.
Right.
It's not only horrific, but it's racialized to the, it's racially based and justified.
Right.
And that doesn't, it really does not sit well with a lot of people like, with William Voltaire. With these other names are escaping me right now. I can't believe I'm forgetting them. But a lot of their reaction is against the Atlantic slave trade. So what I don't think you can say that there was this Enlightenment, because the Enlightenment is a rediscovery of a tradition that had no problem with slavery. So what happens? What is it in human? Aristotle has a very prophetic line. I think it's in his Politics. He says that they'll be slaves until looms move themselves.
Right.
Like what actually happened? When did slavery become the sort of the ball start to roll and then gain momentum, and really you hit a tipping point, let's say in the 1800s?
Right.
What's going on in mid 1800s? You already have industrial revolution. And it's not a coincidence that abolitionism emerges as is it first expressed and then catches on in the two places that had first industrialized and had gained extreme economic prosperity without reliance on slaves: Britain, England, and the northern colonies of what became the United States.
Fascinating. I mean, right? I wonder.
So there's a big. Go ahead.
I wonder if there's. I mean, you say this is very contentious, and you kind of outlined some of the reasons why that might be the case. But I wonder if there could be pushback, as there has been against Whig historiography for the last century or so. But, you know, with, I'm thinking, Great Divergence debates, talking about, and you signal this in your book, the reason, in a sense, this becomes normal later on in much of the Muslim world is because economic development takes a while to get to those parts of the world in the way that capitalist development had taken place.
No, but there's another difference, which is that slavery in the Americas is an economic phenomenon. Slavery in the Islamic world is not economic.
It's social.
It's social. It's a social. That's why it's so hard to get rid of slavery in place, let's say like Saudi Arabia or the Arabian Peninsula or something, because it's not about like, I need this guy to, I need these people to pick cotton in a way where I can make a profit.
Right.
They don't need that. They, but it's how you think about like, how do you have your people, your retinue that you trust? King Abdulaziz bin Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia, who's the guy who's guarding him at all times? When he's praying, he stands behind him with a sword and a rifle at all times.
Right. What's his name?
It's not his brother. It's not his son. It's a slave.
Yeah, of course.
Right. So there's, this is a big difference, is it's when you have, if slavery is an economic phenomenon, and of course it also has social elements as well in the West. But I mean, the point is, if it's mainly economic phenomenon, economic change will change the situation. If it's mostly a social phenomenon, you can have economic change and maybe the social system doesn't change that much. I'm not trying to like whatever flog my own wares, but it's better, I'll just read this from the footnote, so then I don't make a lot of mistakes in recalling it.
Which page is this?
So there's a brief 390 on the footnote. Summary of the debate.
Yeah.
Eric Williams' landmark book, Slavery, Capitalism and Slavery, 1944. Landed and made. Okay, I talk about the moral awakening narrative. The moral awakening narrative is basically says abolitionism happened when human beings basically woke up and were like, holy crap, slavery is wrong. That's basically the narrative, okay? The moral awakening narrative. He landed a major blow against the moral awakening narrative, arguing that Anglo-American abolitionism triumphed in ending the Atlantic slave trade in 1807 because the rise of free trade and industrial production, along with the weakening of mercantilism, meant that the agricultural industries that depended on slavery had entered economic decline by that time. In short, slavery was no longer part of a good business plan. In his 1977 response to this book, Seymour Drescher, in a book called Econocide, showed that far from being in decline, slave-based agricultural production in the Americas had actually entered its peak profitability in the early 1800s. Ending it was, quote, economic suicide for a major chunk of the British and American economy. Moreover, slavery was totally compatible with industrial modes of production. The moral awakening narrative had been right, in effect, says Drescher. Drescher and others since have argued that abolition was brought about by a major change in Anglo-American public sentiment regarding slavery, sentiment that ran counter to economic interests. Other scholars have tried to counter the Drescher school. What Williams had introduced was more than simply the obsolete or incorrect specifics of his decline thesis. It was the notion that the end of slavery ultimately hinged on changes in material circumstances, not the idea of slavery as immoral driving history. They have offered several proposals for reconciling this economic narrative with Drescher's critique. Thomas Haskell argued that the peak profitability of slavery-based production was ultimately marginal in light of the major economic changes afoot on the world stage. So yeah, maybe, things in the Caribbean had entered decline, but if you look globally, like economics was shifting away from a slavery model to one where you have to have workers who are also consumers, things like that. I find Howard Temperley's explanation, which I rely on his attitude, most convincing. So Temperley has a great argument, which he basically says both arguments are correct, the economic narrative and the moral awakening narrative, but they're correct in the sense that they create a feedback loop.
Right.
So people start thinking slavery is wrong because they're able to think it's wrong. So Osama, why don't you think? Like, your family, some of your family lives in India
or Bangladesh.
Okay. Yeah. You go to those families, you say, I just took my kids the other day to like a kind of the place there was chickens and lambs and stuff like that.
Right.
And a lot of kids, they say like, hey, this is a lamb. I don't want to eat lamb chops anymore. If you say that to like a Bengali or Pakistani, what do they say?
They'll laugh at you, right?
Yeah, like, what are you talking about? You're crazy. You're a crazy person. You want me to die of starvation? Like, this is meat. If I get meat, that means I'm actually going to have real chance to develop a brain. So these are luxury. Once you have the luxury to start thinking about moral issues, you start thinking about them, and you can start kind of coming to new moral realizations, like a more refined morality. So this starts happening in places where they don't need slaves, Northern United States, Great Britain, as they start to industrialize. And then they start to see, like, wow, we're actually doing things like we're inventing water wheels and we're inventing, you know, steam power and trains. The world is changing. Suddenly the world is actually, the world is something you can change. Progress is happening. You're at the forefront. We're getting better. We're the leaders. We're morally superior. Then you start saying, I can actually express this moral sentiment that I think slavery is wrong. Ask other people to believe that. They can get kind of join onto the bandwagon as well. And then economic change starts happening there as well. People don't need slavery in other places as well. It catches on. It becomes easy to get rid of slavery. They become morally convinced of this. So the moral awakening, the beginning is economic change in certain places, but then that creates a moral sentiment that changes, and that creates part helps create more economic development, and it sort of like snowballs into this like a feedback loop, as I said.
Although, just in terms of the language that you used, I mean, the challenge from an Islamic theological perspective is to describe that as more morally refined, partly because we look back at the Prophet as a moral example.
No, but it is more morally refined. I mean, think about this. So it's not about good or bad or better or worse. So if you, how often are Muslims supposed to bathe according to the Sunnah of the Prophet?
Like once a week is typical, right?
Okay. Yeah. Osama, do you ever talk to anybody who bathes once a week? No, I'm serious. Not. Like if I meet someone, like I'm kind of an asshole. So I'll be honest, I'm kind of an asshole. So if I meet someone, like, man, you stink. This not only do I don't want to be around that guy is, I think he's a bad person. Right. So like we start to think like there's something wrong with this person. They're not civilized, right?
Right, right.
But there's nothing morally wrong with bathing once a week.
Right, right.
There's nothing morally wrong with it.
But that judgment comes naturally almost.
It's because this is because custom creates morality.
Right.
So
right.
But that doesn't mean I would rather die than say that I'm a better person than the Prophet.
Sure. I mean, that's part of your theological.
I would rather die than say I'm a better person than Omar bin Khattab or Ali bin Abi Talib.
Right, right.
But that's what I mean by more refined morality. It's not about being better. It's about having like all these other issues are taken care of. Where you're going to eat, how you're going to sleep, your health is taken care of pretty much. Now you're worried about these other things. These other things is kamaliyat in the language of maqasid al-sharia, the kamaliyat, the tahsiniyat, become major issues.
Yeah.
So that's what I think is. And by the way, I didn't talk about this at all. Is that that's why the best argument, in my opinion, for abolition in the Islamic tradition is when you go back and you look in like Shatibi and his muwafaqat and things like that.
Yeah.
He says one of the not the main aims of the Sharia, but one of the aims of the Sharia is freeing people, emancipating people.
Fascinating. Yeah.
So if we are now in a position where we don't need, there's no economic need for slavery.
Right.
We can fulfill that. Yeah. Mandate for emancipation by just getting rid of the whole category of slavery and fulfill one of the maqasid of the Sharia. This is an entirely Islamically legitimate argument. It's 100% from within the Sharia tradition. Yeah, and someone could say, and this is often said, you hear this, well, you never would have thought about it if it hadn't been for Western abolitionism.
Okay.
Here's the thing. Western people would never have thought about it either. Nobody thought about abolitionism until it became economically possible. Western, it just happens to be that the Industrial Revolution started in England and then North America, Northeastern America.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not because Western people have like some kind of gene where they read some book that makes them love freedom more than other people.
Right, right.
So,
I mean, this is interesting, of course, isn't it? Because you have the kind of more ideological historiography, which says that, no, precisely that, we're more freedom loving. But my impression is currently
Really? Well, I mean, freedom loving for themselves. Everybody's freedom loving for themselves.
Yes,
weren't super freedom loving about like other people.
Yeah, my impression is that the sort of more serious historiography now recognizes the contingency of where the Industrial Revolution ultimately took place, due to various kinds of accidents of history. I'm Jazakumullah Khairan. It's really been wonderful, and I feel very guilty sort of hogging all of the time because there are a bunch of questions.
Look at the questions. So,
if it's all right, I'm going to post them on the screen and then we can read them out, and then inshallah you can sort of. So Actually, so here's a question from Aisha Sayyid. I'm just going to post it if that's right. It says, given that Islam came for the emancipation of all humanity and for liberating from all bonds, demanding submission only to one true God, slavery and concubines is one unanswered dilemma, especially for the youth who find this irreconcilable with the benevolent image of our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. How can we tackle this? And I think you know, this is one of those questions that you have.
Yeah, I get this question a lot. I mean, I get a lot of emails like this. So, look, first thing I would say is, yeah, this is really, like, this is a really hard issue. And I would actually, I'm not trying to turn it around on this person. I would ask people to ask themselves, like, okay, it's not like I'm the outlier. We're the outliers. We have to explain why we feel a certain way about this issue. And then I guess this whole issue of changing custom and economics and everything like that, and all the stuff that Osama and I just discussed. Now, so I simply don't think, I mean, I think it's factually incorrect. It is factually incorrect to say that having slaves or allowing slavery is irreconcilable with the benevolent image of the Prophet. That's not true. That wouldn't be true for a Christian in the year 1600 or a Muslim in the year 1600 or a Buddhist in the year 1600, right? They just would not, this would not be an issue. Just like, by the way, even people who are trying to find dirt about the Prophet's personal life to insult him with, which is, you know, essentially all the opponents of Islam, not until 1905 did any of them say he married Aisha when she was 9 years old and that's messed up. Because they didn't care about that stuff. No one cared about that before. Okay. So the point is, the what's changed is not, we have to ask ourselves, why are we looking at the way the world in a certain way? There's nothing wrong with the way we look at the world, as I said. There's nothing, ending slavery and freeing slaves and improving people's conditions, is no one's going to debate that that's good. That's one of the aims of the Sharia. But that doesn't mean that it should be impossible for us to imagine that people in the past didn't have as strong a reaction as we do. Now, another thing that's really interesting is slavery was a dilemma for Muslims. And you can see this in the Sunnah of the Prophet. But it wasn't a moral dilemma, it was a theological dilemma. And this is a very famous hadith, right? So the Prophet says in Sahih Muslim and other books, don't say to your slaves abdi or emeti. Say ghulami or jariyati. Don't say my slave or my female slave. Say my boy or my girl. Slaves, don't say about your owners rabbi, my master. Say maulaya, my sponsor or my patron, right? Because in the version of Abu Dawood, the one God is a Rabb huwa Allah, and you're all slaves. So if a Rabb, the Lord, is God, and we're Ibad Allah or we're Abid, we're all the slaves of God. How do you have a slave who's also the owner of another slave, who's a Rabb of another slave? So this idea of there's an anxiety about making sure that the relationship between God and human beings, between the Lord and the slaves of the God, is not mixed up with the relationship between the slave and the owner of the slave. But there's a tension there that Muslims try to sort of pushed down or allied away by saying that this relationship is not like a master slave relationship. It's like a patron junior relationship, although the person is owned, right?
Yeah.
Now, So that's what I'd say. It actually is a dilemma, but a theological one. And when go ahead. Sorry.
I wonder if I could also mention. I mean, like. There, it's a multi-layered tradition. I think we need to develop a historical consciousness to a certain extent, because you have this beautiful Appendix 1, A Slave Saint of Basra, which I recommend everyone to read. It's just you know, 3 pages, but this extraordinary anecdote about this kind of a wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who's a slave, and very poignant in many respects. And so, you know, there are ways in which
but it's not, I think, just that, right? Yeah. This other major scholar in the city, two major scholars, they buy the guy, and he's like, why are you buying me? Yeah. I'm not like a very good servant.
Yeah.
He says, I don't serve creatures, and Allah, and la akhdam al makhluq, and akhdam al khaliq.
Right.
I serve the creator. I don't slave creature. And they say, no, you don't understand. We want to be your students. They say, we want to serve you and be your students.
Yeah. I mean, subhanAllah, because, you know, I mean, it's just such a striking story. I don't want to necessarily ruin it. It's a true story. It's not like this fictional novel that I don't want to ruin for you, but it's just, it's really poignant, I think. I personally think about this in historical terms, as you said, that, you know, there are these historical shifts that have taken place that give us these modern sensibilities that we don't need to deny and say, you know, this is wrong and we're going to reject it. But that shouldn't also cause us to reject and deny the sort of the station of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And I think those two things are, you know,
honestly, I think it's healthier. Like, I think there's something very unhealthy and unproductive and unsustainable about the way the rhetoric, the moral rhetoric, is working. And let's just take UK and America. You can just say, like, if you say that, I mean, if you say that if you were involved in a slave trade, that you are kind of beyond repair, right? So I'm not sure it's really healthy to have that view of our past, where that we are so morally certain about things and black and white about things, because I think that it doesn't acknowledge the like changes in sentiment, right? And I think that when you think about it more as like, you know, I'm trying to improve the people's lots as best as I can. We are all trying to do that, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're better than people in the past, or that we have to condemn people in the past.
Hmm.
You stop thinking about in these like kind of morally black and white terms. I think it's actually more, and by the way, it makes it possible to think about your opponents as well. So you're a conservative or a Republican or a Democrat or a liberal, you know, labor, stop being evil because they see the world in a certain way, and they start being, you know, someone who has different views about certain interests or certain priorities. Right. And that's someone you can negotiate with and deal with a lot better.
I think you highlight in the book the reason for this kind of uncompromising moralizing about this question, which, you know, we recognize and we see all the time, but in a sense the abolitionists needed to project that in order to, you know, persuade everyone, look, we just have to stop this now.
And, yeah, because slave owners would say, like, look, you're right, this guy is a bad slave owner, he treats his slaves terribly, I don't do that, you know.
Right.
Or like, look, I understand you guys have legitimate concerns, so you know what we're going to do, we're going to make sure these slaves are treated well, and then we agree. Okay, so then it was in order to kind of make it something non-negotiable, they had to make it non-negotiable.
Yeah. I wanted to switch over to the remaining questions. Ibn Battuta 7 says, Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh.
The other questions. I think a lot of them are I already answered.
Yes, you've already answered. So I'm just going to at least read them for the so that their voices don't get sort of silenced, as it were. Yusuf Ali was saying, classical Islamic jurisprudence say anything about turning free people into slaves? And you kind of covered that. I mean, in essence, my understanding is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, the only context in which you can enslave people really in the Islamic tradition was, in battle, right? And, you know, modern scholars basically said, and that was at the discretion of the imam, and so it's possible to even stop that. I really found fascinating this point you made, that a lot of later scholars said, look, we cannot, buy and sell slaves anymore from outside, because we have no way of knowing whether they're actually legitimate slaves or not. And I mean, this kind of goes in tension with Ehud Teledana's remark, which you commented, replenishing slaves from the outside, which was in a sense a socioeconomic imperative. I wonder if you could briefly maybe comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, so the thing you're talking about is a relatively, I mean, it's a minor discussion in the sense that it doesn't have a big impact. So they don't, but what they're saying is, if you are not sure that a slave has been legally enslaved, should you buy them or not?
Right.
And the overall answer is, if you want to be careful, don't buy them. But bottom line is you can, because you're going to assume that, like, for example, Osama, when you go to Aldi's or whatever people go to, you know, you go to like the local store, you don't know where, maybe this guy stole all the eggplants you're buying and all the cucumbers, right? You don't know. But we go around and we operate as if everybody's getting these legally, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to buy.
Yeah, we wouldn't be able to operate, right?
Yeah. So basically they're saying the same thing, which is that, in general, just assume that everything is, if you know this person was not gotten legally, you can't. And by the way, here they're not even talking about, if they're a Muslim and they were enslaved, you cannot buy them.
Right.
That's it. You cannot buy them.
Right.
Can't. But that debate is specifically about, was the khums tax paid? Because if someone went out in a raid into like Central Asian steppe and brought this guy back, that person should pay a tax to the imam as part of the khums. And if you don't know they've done that, then has the person legally been enslaved? So that's actually that debate. The other debate, which we see with like people like Ahmed Baba, and this is very common in the Maliki school of law, where there's, you know, in the Sudan area, Sahel area, or also in Central Asia, is if you get someone who is claims to be Muslim,
right?
And there are the general rules also. If they say they're Muslim, the burden of proof is on the person who got them, who captured them or something.
Fascinating.
To prove that they're not Muslim, which is very hard to do.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's also important to remember that most slaves probably were brought into Islamic civilization not through capture, but through buying them from slave merchants who brought them from some other place, who got them either from some way or the other. Right. And there's even a debate amongst Muslim scholars about whether you can do that, because you don't know if those people have been legally enslaved. But again, the rule that kind of wins out is like, you just assume that this guy got them legally. Yeah. And if it's according to their crazy customs that they have, if that's all right for them, then you can buy them.
Yeah, I mean, the pragmatism of law kind of wins out. It makes sense legally speaking. Obviously, it's kind of like, it grates for modern sensibility, certainly. The other sort of questions, as you mentioned, we kind of had a discussion about, someone was asking about abolition and the Industrial Revolution and the debate that you mentioned between Eric Williams and Seymour Drescher. But there's one last question, which is, it's an interesting one here. I would like to understand the wisdom behind Dr. Brown locating being Muslim and American as opposing identities in the introductory part of the text. And I didn't feel it was opposing, but I'd be interested to...
Yeah, it's not opposing. I think maybe I meant by that is that they're two kind of, they're two, I talk about the kind of, you know, American slavery conundrum and the Islamic slavery conundrum.
Right.
They're similar, but not identical. But I mean, in the case of, which is that as an American, you have this issue of the kind of the founding fathers and Thomas Jefferson, the same guy who wrote the Declaration of Independence and, which is a, you know, a very compelling document. And, you know, the guy had children with his slave woman. But the Islamic one is different, which is it's similar, but, you know, the Prophet Muhammad is not like Thomas Jefferson. I could say, you know what, forget Thomas Jefferson. You know what, take his statue down. I don't care. Forget about him. I mean, you can't, if you're a Muslim, you can't say that about the Prophet. So they're similar, but there's differences between the two. So I think I was more trying to say that they're two different kind of discussions, each with its own characteristics.
Jazakallah khairan. This has really been, thank you so much for your time. I mean, an hour and 40 minutes. And I'm also grateful for all the questions that were sent in. I cannot encourage enough people to read this book. Go ahead and purchase it, inshallah, and have a read of it. I think it's just a tour de force of so many different disciplines, moral philosophy, sort of wider epistemological questions. I found the discussion on nominalism very interesting. history that is very wide-ranging. Do you mind if I ask how many books you read for this? Did you you have a bibliography, which is a select bibliography in the text, but it's long enough.
And then I actually left out the bibliography is just books I cited in the footnotes.
Right,
but
right.
I actually realized I left some out, which is kind of annoying. But I don't know. I read a lot of books, but I was very driven, you know, and I did this. I was, I don't know. Maybe this is the same for everybody, but for me, like when I write books, I become like obsessed. You know, my wife is like, this guy's going crazy. He doesn't sleep. He doesn't do anything else. So, it's a very intense, experience.
Perhaps in closing, I can just ask what you're working on currently.
Yeah, so it's funny, when I wrote this book, I was like, okay, yeah, I'm writing a book about slavery, but no, I'm never going to write a book about race, because that's crazy. I would never do that. I was like, not a million years. And then, I actually still would say, then last summer, there was this debate in this, I think it's called Research Africa, listserv, where there's this one thing called Afrocentrism, or like Kemet Afrocentrism, and you see this, it also kind of goes back to this guy, and I think his name's Chancellor Williams, and the kind of conservative Christian minister in the U.S. in the early 20th century. This idea that like Islam is this, you know, Islam is sort of like has slavery in its DNA, Muslims, and then Arabs hate black, you know, Islam is anti-black, Arabs are enslaved black people. Islam is a colonial presence in Africa. It's not really an indigenous part of Africa. So I was, it's all saying Islam is anti-black. So I was really, someone asked me specific questions about things that had come up in this debate about hadiths and say, can you answer this, that, and this? So I started looking into it. I was like, you know what? I need to answer this bigger question. So now I'm writing a book called Is Islam Anti-Black? And it's actually, it's getting close to being done.
Okay.
And it won't be a big book. It'll be a smaller book.
Right.
But that's fine.
Mashallah. So actually directly connected to this book, but I was under the impression that you were going to be writing on the notion of siyasa and qanun.
Yeah, I have that book. It's like 90% done, but I can't finish it.
Because you're distracted by this project.
Other stuff comes up.
Mashallah. Jazakumullah khair. No, I mean, I think it's a great service, actually, because your books are a great service on two levels. Of course, the academic community, but also I think the wider Muslim community can really benefit from these texts. And it's really wonderful to have like someone who's doubling as that sort of Muslim theologian and professor at Georgetown, so to speak. So we look forward to that, and inshallah, I will definitely bring you back, when you're available, because I'd love to have the opportunity to discuss some of your other books. But jazakumullah khairan for your time today. It's really been sort of wonderful to have you, and I look forward to inviting you back before long. Jazakumullah khairan for everyone who's stuck around for, you know, nearly 2 hours at this point. This has really been enlightening for me, and I've benefited a great deal from also the questions that you're asking, Professor Brown. And I hope you will join us in a week's time. Inshallah, I'll have another author we're in conversation with, inshallah, at that point.
My pleasure.
Until then, Jazakumullah khairan again, Jack, and we will be in touch in the near future. Fi amanillah.
Subhanakallahumma
wa bihamdik. أشهد أن لا إله إلا أنت نستغفرك ونتوب إليك السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته